Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello.
this is Jana Byers, and I am here with Martina Svinar, the author of Soviet Signoras, Personal and Collective Transformations in Eastern European Migration, out with the University of Chicago Press from 2019. Hello, Martina. How are you today?
Great. Hi. Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Oh, it's wonderful to talk to you. I really enjoyed your book, and I'm really happy to hear about it and to get to know you. So let's start there. Tell me a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, so I'm Martina Svinar. I'm a migrant, actually, and I was born in what once was called Yugoslavia and then Croatia. And then I moved to Italy many, many years ago. I live in northeast of Italy and work at a university that it's called Trento. I'm in a department in psychology and cognitive sciences, and I'm an ethnographer, technically a sociologist, but I prefer to describe myself as an ethnographer. I did a PhD in sociology in Trento, and then basically throughout my academic career, I've spent extended chunks of time, especially in the US, again, for research purposes. I work mainly on migration, but as the book you have read and I hoped you liked, I like to address migration from an angle that is different from, what is usually, if I may say so, asked when it comes to migrants. So I'm, in a way, interested what migrants do when they do not work. So I'm basically, I guess that the best description would be that I do research on migrants when migrants basically are not our hands to describe them in that way. I'd say that's it.
Wonderful. All right. So, I think that as an immigrant, I'm an immigrant as well. I think as a migrant, it's I can see part of how this topic was of interest to you. How did you decide to do this work?
Yeah, as you said, it's. I think that there is something about ourselves when we experience things in life. We are kind of, or at least I'm curious to, in a way, to understand them. So, Soviet Signoras basically stemmed from my experience as a migrant, but also from the fact that I was a particular type of migrant back in the day when I came to the area where I did my research. So as I said, I'm from Eastern Europe, and I kind of always thought that I'm familiar with Eastern Europe. I must add now, 20 years later, in a very naive way, because I come from a different Eastern Europe than the one I afterwards addressed in my research. And I guess that my, Soviet Signoras just came about when I was experiencing and observing this new inflow of migrants, different Eastern European migrants, namely coming from the territories of the former USSR, basically to an area where I came some years before. And I was seeing in them, in a way, some kind of struggles that I have gone through before them. So I was just, yeah, curious to get in touch with them.
Yeah, wonderful. I mean, the migration, it's such a point where you can see really people's lives and what matters to you. You know, as a migrant, you take what you take with you, what you're willing to let go, how much you want to keep from your old country. It's really telling about values. It's an interesting lens to look through society at. And, you know, while we're talking about the production of this book, would you like to talk for a minute about your methods?
Yeah. So as I said, I like to describe myself as an ethnographer. When I started my PhD, which was in 2004, I kind of struggled with what do I want to do and what would be the research I would love to do, and the one also with which I could have a little bit of fun, because I think that research is way better if we have fun doing it and if we really enjoy it and not just understanding as a work that you need to do in order to accomplish your thesis. And I was very lucky to have a very good supervisor who basically allowed me to the possibility of thinking that a lengthy ethnography could be a way to go for a PhD. Plus, you know, ethnography gave me the possibility to really be there with people, which is something that a lot of the social sciences today kind of treats, in a way that maybe does not allow us to be there and to observe for lengthy periods of time. Now, I'm not saying that ethnography should last for almost two decades like mine. Maybe that's not the way to go. But, you know, I would just like to see more younger scholars, or in general, more scholars contemplating ethnography for real, you know, seriously, saying I'm doing an ethnography and I'm investing an XYZ number of years in doing it. I'm conscious about the fact that I'm doing, but also, you know, academia should be conscious about the fact that these methods allows me to get so close to my, to my subject, and allows me to really be in the situation and understand, as you said, the values, the norms, the behaviors that are just, you know, they're more difficult to understand through many other methods, which I'm not discarding. But, you know, I think that ethnography gives you the possibility to ask a lot of questions that naturally arise from just being in the field.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's such a time commitment. I mean, as you said, your time commitment, what is almost 20 years
almost
here?
Almost 20 years, yes. Well, if you think that, you know, the book came out in 2019, I started the PhD in 2004, but prior to that, I already had about 2 years of research experience. So yeah, I'm hitting the second decade.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, that's a big investment in time. And the academy doesn't give us a lot of space for that, right? That's not how it works. You need to produce.
Yes, exactly. Production is, with ethnography, production is something that becomes more complicated, but not only because of time constraints, but I also find it very difficult to, you know, fit my findings in an article type of product. I'm discussing with other ethnographers, actually it's something that also they experience. So also the format of our research products has to be a little bit a little bit different. And in a world where you are kind of expected to meet certain goals, which again, I'm not saying that it's wrong, but ethnography, it's difficult to fit in ethnography in a timing of a young academic.
Yeah, absolutely. Somebody who needs to get, and if you're in the U.S. system, like the American system, where you need to get tenure and you have to produce, you've got a 3-year review and a 6-year review. And yeah, that makes it much more difficult. And I mean, it takes some time, and you are also making a gamble that maybe at the end you won't have anything to say. Thankfully, that didn't happen here. You have a lot to say. But, you know, you can spend a lot of time watching something and realizing it's not really much of a phenomenon at all.
Absolutely. But, I agree. Yeah, I agree.
So it's a gamble, one that really paid off for you. So let's dive in. I would like you to tell me, and if you can, this is such a huge question, but as succinctly as possible, what you feel to be your major, like your main argument here in Soviet Senoras.
I guess my overarching argument is probably the fact that migration changes people, and it changes them according to directions that those people, so the subjects who experienced migration, were not able to foresee before they migrated. So I see it as a dynamic process that can make you kind of change your path dependently on what happens in this along this path. Usually migrants are seen as people who move to a specific country or a specific area of the world because they need to work, they need to send money back home. But it's very rare that somebody tries to describe or to analyze the changes that happen to an individual or to a group of individuals, like I did in this book, you know, the changes that are brought by migration. So one thing is the fact that your economic status is getting better with migration. You're sending home remittances, you're rebuilding your house, you're paying, you know, for your kids' education, you are buying them a house, so on and so forth. These are all tangible and measurable changes that happen as a consequence of migration. And the push factors that basically one migrates because needs to do X, Y, Z. You know, you get a to-do list as a migrant. But then when you migrate, you understand that something way more deeper has happened to you as an individual. And since individuals do not exist just in their individualistic form, but they are part of communities and groups and they constantly interact with people, those changes can be traced along groups. So I would say that my overarching argument is basically a description of how migration changes people. And I think I was able to do that because I was extremely lucky to observe a group of pioneer migrants. Usually when we get to migration, we oftentimes, you know, because of how migration works and because of how research works, we oftentimes get retrospective accounts of how was it when you migrated to Spain? How was it, you know, what were the difficulties that you experienced during your travel? I don't know. From Greece to Italy, or from Libya to Italy, as for the forced migrations we are seeing now. But technically, I was there in the first days when they came. So I kind of did not need to ask them to give me their account of how was it to settle in the area where they settled in, but I observed their settlement process and the process that followed afterwards, meaning the changes that they experienced as individuals and as a group.
So you use a term, pioneer migrants. Could you explain that?
Yeah. Pioneer migrants are actually the first generation of migrants. So when I started the research in Italy, there were literally almost no former USSR migrants. I reconstructed the data, and just to give you an example, in at the end of the 90s, there were, speaking of regular migrants, just 5 Moldovan people and 0 people from Ukraine. I'm not saying that they were not in Italy. I'm saying that they were not regular. So basically, when if you compare that data with the data that we have today in Italy, we have 250,000, so 250,000 Ukrainians regularly living in Italy. The number of Moldovans is slightly smaller, but you know, together, all if you combine all the former USSR citizens in Italy today, it's more than they are getting close to a million. So it was a really a big thing when they started coming. I mean, they started being really visible in the cities where they moved to. So when I say pioneers, I'm really speaking about first generation migrants. But they're pioneers because they started a flow. So when you say first generation migrant, you are usually referring to a migrant that it's the first individual from his or her, from one's family, basically moving to a different country. But in this case, they were the ones who basically built up a migration flow. And one thing that it's... I think important to learn about this migration flow, it's probably the fact that it's an 80%, it was born as a female migration flow and it remained as such. So we get to, you know, peaks like 8 out of 10, for example, Ukrainian citizen in Italy are women, which basically means that the flow started as a female one, but it also maintained itself as a female one, even with numbers skyrocketing as the ones that I have just described to you.
That's really remarkable. I mean, you have this remarkable situation in a couple ways. I mean, first of all, right, how migration works is that you somebody goes to a place, but then that becomes, you have chain migration, that place becomes a location for new people. So very few people, you know, as an American, very few people come over and they're the first people left. If they're from India, they have a connection with a group of people from their country or from their region, and they move to a community where other Indians live or other Chinese people or other Italians. So this is remarkable. And then the gender question, right? The idea that this is a female migration is also very new.
So yeah, well, I mean, it's new with regards to Europe. There are other examples of female flows around the world. I mean, the book, in my book, I tried. I don't know how well I succeeded. Mm-hmm. We'll see what the reviewers will say. but you know, I had to establish a dialogue with other examples like this one around the world. So clearly. The one example to, let's say the literature stream with which I had to dialogue with was clearly the Mexican migration to the U.S. and a little bit of, for example, the Filipino migration in either in the Middle East or in other parts of Asia. So there are examples like that, but they are not. They did not remain as purely gendered as the one that I'm speaking here. Plus, if you just Google female Ukrainian migration or female USSR migration, it's still something that among gender scholars and among migration scholars, it's way, way, way understudied. I tried to guess why would that be so. Honestly, I think that people have difficulties in grasping how big the numbers are.
Yeah, I'm sure that's the case.
So yeah,
that's and you do engage with this scholarship. I just think it's a very you've caught this moment, right? You have this very interesting moment to discuss. Okay, so let's move into the book itself. So your first chapter, A Room of One's Own, Managing Spaces, Lives, and Laws in Residential Care Work. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah. Can I add just a little thing before that?
Of course.
Sorry.
No, absolutely.
To tell you the truth, I'm really proud of my three or four pages of prologue.
Oh, they're wonderful. Yes. Let's start with your prologue.
I'm so sorry.
You are absolutely right. It's such a great, it's such a beautiful introduction. Well, and it lets us know how personal this is and how much you're involved in this work. So please,
exactly. That's what I wanted to tell you. So basically, I opened the book with something that it's not so usual to find in books. So I wanted kind of the reader to get really intimate with what I was about to describe and how, let's say, deeply changing the phenomena that then I tackled throughout the next chapters, how really deep this idea of personal change and group dynamics will become throughout the book. So I basically closed the prologue by saying that the people who participated in the scene that I'm describing have learned how to think in a different way. So they have learned how to be different people, which is, in a way, the substance of this whole book. So I'm really proud of my prologue. I'm sorry. I'm a little bit egoistic, but I'm really totally proud. But now we can jump to, the chapters. As you before that said, a room of one's own. Basically, I'm tackling a dimension of that it's a work dimension in the lives of the women I'm doing the research with, but I'm not tackling it from the point of view of the job that they're doing. First of all, most of them at the beginning, well, the vast majority of them at the beginning was a 24/7 care worker. Which basically meant that they needed to share the house, the apartments of the elderly they cared for. So I was not interested in the work dynamic, but I was interested in how they shared the space and how they coexisted in a work environment that at the same time is really, really private and intimate for the elderly they care for, but it's also work settlement and a living space for the women who were employed. So there was what I observed was a really strong tension between, on the one side, the necessities that the women had, a room, a bed, a cupboard, a little bit of space where to put, your clothes, your personal items, the photograph of your kids, so on and so forth. And on the other side, I observed the reluctance of the employers to have a person who is not really family, but who cares for you also from an intimate point of view. And here I refer to all the literature on body work, and there has been a widely researched. So, what I've seen hundreds of scenes where the elderly, for example, would not allow the care worker to, I don't know, store her clothes in the wardrobe because there were still the clothes from, the husband that died 15 years before. Or a lot of women were not allowed to, most of the women, in fact, were not allowed to have friends coming over because that was not their house. A lot of women, for example, did not have their own restroom, but needed to share the restroom of the elderly. And as we know, a lot of restrooms for elderly people need to be adapted for the necessities of the elderly people. Plus, let's speak about food. Women in the countries where they come from, they eat different food than the Italian food. So not only they were not able to reproduce the expectation of the elderly, like eating pasta every day.
All day, every day.
But they were really good in, preparing pierogi. Mm-hmm. And guess what? The elderly doesn't even know what a pierogi is. And, stuff like that. That looks a little bit comical. But when you leave it on your own skin, it leaves a deep trace, and it basically just underlines that you, as a, as an immigrant woman, as a care worker, you have been stripped of your status, of your decency, and you just became a sidelki, which is a care worker in Ukrainian and in Russian, or as they used to call themselves, an ass washer, lavakuli. It was a very denigrative, but I think it's really mind-blowing the fact that you they described really well what they meant with that word. So in a way, I wanted to describe this quest for privacy that could not be achieved in the homes of your employers. And then I described the struggle for having these privacy places. First of all, seeing the need for privacy, and then also how they developed it throughout my research. But I don't want to spoil completely the chapter, because otherwise people are not going to read me, so no.
No, so that'll do. Yeah, that's very good. Residential care work is traditionally like gendered female, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's this very, I think that you do a good job of pointing out that it's precarious, you know, and because it's where you live, it's about yourself and your home. And there are a lot of women in these situations who are in great danger. That doesn't seem to have been a big deal here, or not as common here with your research. But, it's a thing we talk about with, like, when women come into work as housekeepers, you know, they don't have a lot of recourse, because it's, if they leave their work, they leave their home.
Yeah. In fact, I've observed something like that. For instance, when the elderly person would die. So it's important to state that, you know, those ladies that I observed, if they were able to keep their job and if their families were satisfied with the job, but assuming everything is, you know, okay, the idea is that the care worker will most likely accompany the elderly person till his or her death. What happens when the elderly dies? What I've seen is that, you know, they were given like a snapshot of time, like, 5 days, you're out. Now, imagine moving. First of all, you need to move somewhere else. You need to find a place. You need to find a job. You got to move your stuff. So, notwithstanding that, a lot of the women that I observed throughout the years, they really behaved very lovingly towards the elderly. So, when death came, it was also a death for them. They also lost not only their employer, but also a person whom they learned to love and care for. But then you're absolutely right that to say that nobody protects them in a moment when maybe they would need to get some support before moving on to a different job.
Mm-hmm. And at which point, you know, this community becomes very important as well. Yeah. All right. So chapter 2, Practicing Abundance, Immigrant Women and the Challenge of Consumption.
Yeah. So here I am, it's very difficult that, at least when I did the research, the idea that migrants are also consumers and they can be very good consumers was not really something, there was not a lot of literature on that. So the idea is that those women come from places where their daily life was marked with scarcity, and scarcity, a wide spectrum type of scarcity. So not only food scarcity, but even beauty products, clothing, so on and so forth. And then they move to an area in which they earn a decent amount of money, that it's completely at their disposal. When they start understanding how much money they need to send back home, they also start managing money in a way that they can have something for themselves. And they start, experiencing what consumption means in the Western world. And again, here, I try to trace it almost in a time lapse. What does it mean to start from an ethnic type of consumption to, and I arrive to a wide open type of consumption that resembles, let's say, the consumption behavior of, I would assume, working class native families. And I take the readers throughout different consumption venues that symbolically entail different meanings for the women who are choosing to perform what different typologies of consumption. So migrants come to Italy thinking that consumption is something for tomorrow, but in fact they discover that there are possibilities for them to experience consumption at different levels, and they enjoy it a lot. I mean, I had a lot of fun going shopping around with those, wild ladies. It was really, really, really extremely fun. So yeah,
it sounds great. I'm a big fan of Irina myself.
Oh yeah, I think you should meet her in person. I mean, if I was not bound to kind of protect my sources, it's great.
She seems like a hoot. And the it's interesting, consumption is a way you can demonstrate also that you belong, right? The products you buy change, and you can buy clothing that is fashionable in the new place you live.
Absolutely. So you can start building up your status within the group, slowly within the group through consumption. That is basically the idea that I'm trying to give to the readers in this chapter.
So your next two chapters are both much more intimate. They're the personal kind of romantic relationships or family relationships, strong mothers, great lovers, sexuality and emigration, and then getting serious, courtship, love, and maybe marriage and emigration. And this is a pretty important theme when you're talking about female migration. So would you please address this?
Oh, yeah. Actually, that was the core of my PhD. So when I decided as an adult, I said, intimacy and sexuality are really the topics I want to go for when getting to migration. So the idea of those chapters is that when you migrate, and you migrate alone, things can happen in the area where you migrate to, and those things not always can be are predictable. So this is particularly important for my women, because for them migration was also a deeply transformative process from a female point of view, and that has to do with their age. So I guess I was really, really amazed by the fact that in the early stages of my research, the women would kind of tell me, oh, but you're old, you're not married, oh, you don't have kids, what's wrong with you? In fact, I think that, for a good chunk of time, they might have They believed that there was something wrong with me. Maybe I was even homosexual. So, I was weird, way weird. But why was that? Because, my age, so I'm 45 now, and I was, when I started the research, I was, in my late 20s. They were in their mid-30s, 40s. And for them, when you're in your late 20s, you should already have at least a kid and be already, married. And in fact, they had 1+ kids. And I would say 9 out of 10 were already married. So for them, the perception of age was completely different than what they actually experienced when they got to Italy. In fact, they would tell me, she's 40 and she's not even married yet. I was already divorced twice back then. So, you know, for them, in your early 20s, you should have married and get a kid. In your 40s, you are kind of ready to become a grandmother. Then they get to Italy, and they discover that even when you are 40, there is still a sentimental market for you. So you can be liked by somebody, but you're also allowed to like somebody else. So basically, you're not an old babushka anymore. Which basically produced an incredible effect on how they perceive their intimacy, sexuality, love, and ultimately also marriage. Which basically meant that they, you know, they went really wild at the beginning. So they were they discovered that they can be liked by somebody else. And then they started experimenting also with different types of relationships. You have to imagine that they come from an area where everybody, you know, spoke Russian. So, and the culture was really Soviet. In fact, at the beginning, they all described themselves as Soviet women. So, meaning that they had a shared past. And they get to Italy, where there are already other migrants who have arrived before them. And, you know, they can experiment different types of liaisons with them. So there is a whole, they were able throughout the years to build up a sexual stratification system in which if you date, for example, a Chornienki, which means a black person, it's not as racial as or as racialized as it may seem. But in fact, it denotes a difference between Caucasians and not Caucasians. So for them, Chornienki were basically whatever was Northern African. I mean, technically, I've seen even people from Southern Italy who for them were Chornienki. So, you know, don't take it too seriously. But I like to use the words that they use. So they built up this stratification system in which dating a male that has got specific ethnic, cultural, and also in a way racial, if you want to put it in this term, characteristics gets you to a specific type of relationship. Now, if you date an Italian man, the assumption is that thanks to this relationship, you will most likely be able to regain a status that you perceive you lost through migration, which is why I called the book Soviet Signoras. I forgot to mention that all of the ladies with whom I did the research with, they all had professional experience and were highly educated. So the vast majority has got a university degree. So they basically for them migration is a very very harsh. Let's say harsh and stigmatizing experience of status loss. And through intimacy and sexuality, they think that this status, in fact, through marriages, can be regained because you re-become something that you once were. So you re-become a signora. Plus, in Italy, they discover something that they have never experienced before, which was courtship. So in sensual terms, they all described Italian males as much more passionate and courty than what they have experienced with their own men, whom they called Sovok, which is a male with a Soviet background. Plus, to add a little bit of spice without saying too much, also in terms of sexuality, for them, the experiences that they have in Italy are oftentimes really, really new. And that is something that I found in literature, where the Soviet countries were identified with a procreative type of sexuality, whereas the Western world moved towards more the idea of pleasure within sexuality, which had a lot of repercussions on how you actually perform sexuality. So a lot of sexual acts. So if we take the big umbrella of foreplay, for a lot of women was something that they experienced for the first time in Italy, and before that they never experienced it. So yeah, those two chapters I try to speak to the idea that love, sexuality, and intimacy are something that can actually change your migration trajectory.
And this working kind of as a bridge to our chapter five, marriage gives you a new status as well, right? And suggests that you are an immigrant. You won't be going back. You've settled, right? You are now part of Italian society.
Yeah. You are not going back, and your life is here with a new status, as you justly said, which also meant that since you still remain an immigrant woman, even if you have settled comfortably in your new shoes. And kind of that was the goal for which a lot of women felt they need to create some institutions, basically, in the area where they were. So the last chapter before the conclusion describes how these religious institutions were built and differentiated afterwards, because, you know, in Ukraine there are at least a couple of different churches that needed to be reenacted here. Think about, you know, Belarusia or Georgia or Moldova. So at the turn of the millennium, and I would say I think for the first 5 or 6 years, there were absolutely no religious institutions in the area where I did my research, and then they started popping up slowly. And also thanks to the fact that some women were able to settle permanently in the area. So the chapter kind of tells the story of how hard and how much it was needed to construct these community institutions.
There's a little pushback there from your hosts, the host country, but it's interesting, like then you know that you have a community, right? And this is, I mean, one of the great themes is how a community, how these women build a community and how they change as individuals within the community.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. And then your conclusion, from the detritus of the Soviet Union into a new social world.
Yeah. In the conclusion, I basically I reconnect to the more theoretical introduction, and I basically try to relate what I have discussed throughout the chapters, basically how migration changes people, and I state that this is something that was not previously expected by migrants. And I also say that, you know, migrants expect no scars to be brought back home, but in fact every migrant brings back scars back home, and whatever happens in a here is brought back to a there, to just reference Waldinger's. But I in that closing chapter I address the fact that it's important to study pioneers, because if we really want to understand how communities and migration flows are established, we need to study basically pioneers. I address one final point, and it's the fact that every migrant, aside from the, you know, usual work challenges and legal challenges migrants meet, they're also challenged with the fact that they need to fashion a new self in a novel social environment. So they need to find their own way in order to establish a stable foothold in the environment where they migrated to.
Wonderful. This has been so fun. So tell me, what's next for you? This you've created this, you know, work of great love that represents a good chunk of your life. How do you follow this up?
Well, for now, I'm trying to not to kill my own family.
Oh, right.
And just survive.
So doing the dishes is what's next, right? Yeah.
Yeah. No, I'm actually in the middle of one research which I'm having a lot of fun, even if it's very different from the one that readers will be able to read here. About 2 years ago, I started doing research with the forced migrants in a hosting facility that are basically staying in this facility for until they are not able to solve their status. It's a completely different work for me because I do research on about 300 men.
Wow.
Gender is also in there, but it's way different, and the provenience of those migrants is completely different. So it's namely Africa, Central Africa, and then a little bit of Pakistan. And a little bit of India and Bangladesh. So the idea is that how do they go about establishing their foothold in a reality that is very hostile to them because they are Black, young, and male. So yeah, and I've been doing this for also using ethnographic methods for the past 2 years, and we'll see what will come out of that. So that's, let's say, that's the next step in terms of writing. But I guess that my next move will be, because I like so much sexuality and intimacy, I think they're really important topics for the social sciences. I will be moving to something that broadly stays in the area of sex and tech, so sexuality and technology. How, you know, technology can mold and shape our desires, basically.
Mm-hmm. All right. I'm excited about that. I'm interested to see what happens next. This is such an important topic, right? And we both live in Europe, which is a continent where migration is something we're talking about constantly. It was really nice to have this academic, but full on enjoyable read to think about it, you know, to like help me think about this. So thank you very, very much. Dr. Zviner, we'll talk after your next book. Okay.
Thanks. Thanks for this possibility. And yeah, hope to talk to you with regards to the next book.